Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast.
Hello again, listeners. It's another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. We're recording this after Arsenal won, Sheffield United won, but prior to Arsenal's trip to Stamford Bridge. So that gives you context if you're listening to it a bit later. Joining me to look at the past, look at the future, and all the things in between is Anita Sambol, all the way from Croatia. How are you, Anita?
Hello, Matthew. Yeah, they say it's Blue Monday, the
yep.
worst, the most depressing day of the year today. I wouldn't say I feel more depressed than I was like a month ago with Arsenal, but yeah, let's discuss.
Well, I apart from my journey home on the tube, I had quite a nice day at work today, so I'm reasonably content. The only reason I found out it was Blue Monday is because I kept on getting emails of people trying to sell me shit. No more Blue Monday, buy some stuff. It's like,
yeah, there have been a lot of talk that it's just like many stuff. So right now it's just a marketing ploy, nothing else.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Black Friday idea, literally, that's like, I'm really amazed that that's kind of taken off in the UK now, because it was literally just a thing in the States for years and years and years, and it seems to have suddenly made its way over to Europe. But hey, it was okay because me and my girlfriend bought each other our Christmas presents on Black Friday for a reduced price. So maybe there's something to it. Anyway,
we're not. Wait.
Yeah, exactly. We're not here to promote people selling shit. We're here to promote Arsenal, who, I don't know, will try and sell us shit, but with limited success when it's not an Adidas football shirt. So we obviously returned to home comforts at the weekend, sans Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. And found ourselves being rather disappointed with a 1-1 draw with Sheffield United. Before we sort of get into the detail of it, Anita, how did you feel about it? That scoreline is an overall reflection of the game.
Oh, well, it was really... It hurt, you know, to concede such a goal so late in the match when we haven't looked fantastic, but we weren't so bad, and we had our chances, especially during the first half. And it's just really frustrating that yet another match we take the lead and don't score second or even third goal, and then concede to a poor deflection. Not even to mention the goal referee.
I'm sure that might get a mention as we go a little bit later. yeah, I mean, as you say, it felt a bit of a gut punch, the equalising goal for Sheffield United, because it was seeming like a game we were toughing out despite not playing very well.
Yeah.
I mean, first things first, I have to say that, I mean, I'd seen enough of them this season to be impressed with Sheffield United, but just watching them for 90 minutes again, they're incredibly well coached, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. You can see that they definitely deserve the position they are in at the moment, really. I mean, how long has he been with them, the manager?
I think 3 or 4 years, something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got them promoted twice, so...
Definitely, as I think Adrian Clark said in the breakdown, well-drilled team, and I think that that's a really good description of how they look.
I mean, what I find so impressive about them, I mean, quite apart from the fact they've got the second best defensive record in the league as a promoted team, which you just never hear normally.
Yeah.
But also the fact that, you know, with these overlapping centre halves and the way they switch the play, you know, he's presenting teams with tactical problems that are quite tricky to work out because it allows them to be so solid defensively. I mean, obviously, they're not going to score a lot of goals because they don't have many, well, top-level attacking players, which is of no fault of their own. I mean, Jesus, some of those players have been with them since they're in League One. But I was just so impressed watching, particularly in that first half when we were really struggling with them before we scored the goal, because there was such cohesion to what they were doing that, because obviously, you know, I'm a bit of a football spanner. I've seen most of these players play for other teams and be crap, you know, for other teams, or at least, you know, you wouldn't think they could survive outside the Championship. But he's managed to get them where their ability to cover for each other and their ability to know where each other are going to be, both defensively and attacking. I mean, it's you have to kind of give massive admiration to the job the coach has done, and also the ability of those players to adapt to playing at higher and higher levels. I mean, sure, that obviously they probably wouldn't thrive as well out of such a well-drilled system. And a challenge would be when, after staying up, they have more money to invest in players. And can you be as successful getting people who don't owe you as much to buy in so totally is always a challenge. But, I mean, every time I've seen them this season, I've just been like, you know, this. I don't know what would happen if this coach could thrive at a team where he has a more expansive responsibility because of what's expected and a more attacking responsibility. But for what he's done, I mean, wow. I just want to kind of, even though it cost us and they've taken 4 points off of this season, I kind of feel like I want to clap them, because it's just like that collection of players should not be anywhere near as effective as they are. So, you know,
I think many people feel the same, especially the commentators on Saturday on my stream. I was watching, I think it was NBC from US.
Yeah.
I mean, they literally, you can feel like the commentator stood up and clapped and was so happy when they scored the equalizer. I think that really pissed me off. They were cheering for them the whole match, and perhaps I would if I was a neutral. But it's just not very fair.
Yeah, I mean, it is a little bit grating. I mean, there are certain commentary teams out there that have, you know, say the player that's working alongside the commentator. I mean, obviously the commentators, they want whatever's going to be the best story. That's their job, so they have to push for that. And of course, Arsenal beating Sheffield United at home, not a story. Sheffield United coming back from a goal down, it's a story. And obviously then you've got the co-commentators, nearly all of whom have played extensively for rival London clubs at some point or another, or have played for Liverpool and Man United, and therefore have no interest in Arsenal winning. I mean, did you have the stream with Tony Gale?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those people, he's sort of mildly anti-Arsenal. He sort of generally seems to want us to lose if possible, but if we play well and win, he's very complimentary. But if we're not playing that well, he wants to see us lose, I think.
But that just goes, you know, with that feeling that we often have as Arsenal fans, that everyone is against us, that everyone hates us, all the media, the papers, the referees, everyone just, you know, can't wait to see us fail. And yeah, it's just not really nice.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's partly that what you deal with being a big club that isn't presenting a great story. You know, I mean, I remember when we had the Invincibles team and the 98 team, you know, because we were playing such fucking good football, the commentators were kind of, you know, some of them obviously were still kind of wanting the big story of us losing, but there was enough of them just kind of going, this team's really good. You know, and when you get any team that operates at that level, you know, like Liverpool are now, everyone's kind of loving how well Liverpool are doing right now. And I'm kind of like, well, that's fair enough. But otherwise, if you're a big club and you're not doing brilliantly, you're there to get shot at, particularly if you don't have that many loyalists in the media. I mean, we've got Lee Dixon, Martin Keown and Ian Wright flying the flag for Arsenal. So we're doing better than we have done in some previous league when there have been no ex-Arsenal players in the press at all.
Well, those three that you mentioned are often very, very critical of Arsenal as well.
Well, to be fair, Ian Wright's critical right up to the moment that something good happens, and then he's incredibly happy. and Lee Dixon's just like, why don't all the fullbacks know where to stand? And Martin Keown's just like, if it's not brilliant, it's not good enough. I think he's sort of generally critical of a lot of it. But it's also that difficult thing that if you're an ex-player for a team, you have to be slightly more careful when covering that team, I guess.
Sometimes it feels like they are forcing themselves to be a bit more negative than they actually are about the team, just so they don't get accused that they are overly fond of the team.
I mean, obviously, some people don't bother with it. I mean, Jermaine Jenas is so fucking biased to Spurs, it's not even funny. I mean, it's not as bad as Garth Crooks, who used to get really upset every time Spurs didn't win, or every time Arsenal won. He'd generally get kind of like he wanted to just sulk and go home. And obviously, you got Jim Beglin, who does a lot of who's an ex-Liverpool player, who's tries to hide his glee. But, you know, I don't know.
It's when, football.
Yeah, exactly. To be honest, I don't really give a toss about the commentators. It's more the referees I'm worried about.
Some influence.
So obviously, Sheffield United started the game really, really well, and we were struggling to get out, but we started to come more into it. Pepe was creating chances, sort of counter attacks, or just running at their defence. As we saw at Bramall Lane earlier in the season, he was a threat that, because obviously, if you have a really compact, rigid system that's incredibly well drilled, it's hard to break it through normal passing options, so it takes more of people taking individual responsibility, hence the reason why Pepe is more of a danger to a team with that kind of structure. And so he had the cross to Martinelli that Martinelli didn't quite connect with and volleyed wide, which was a difficult chance, and then there was the half chance again where it was played through to Martinelli, who made the run to the right edge of the box but couldn't get his foot around the shot. But by then we were coming more into the game, we'd got a bit more possession and control, and of course we got the goal.
Yeah, definitely. I was a bit worried how it will look without Aubameyang. I mean, he hasn't really been on top of his game this season so far, but I mean, he's still the top scorer, and you can kind of count that he will score one or two chances that he gets, if he gets a lot of them. And as being at home and playing in front of the full stadium, you expect that there will be more chances than usual. But I think Martinelli really did well, and Pepe actually had a really fantastic game.
Yeah, I mean, I think Pepe faded a bit in the second half, as he has done a bit this season, and partly his tactical adjustments went around him. But there's no doubt that Martinelli's got that thing which really has makes him stand out, which is his ability off the ball. It's not that traditional Brazilian kind of, we normally think of Brazilian footballers and we think of people doing, you know, wonderful dribbling or clever flicks or whatever, but he's all about off the ball movement, and his ability to get into goal scoring positions, whether playing centrally or wide and slightly away from defenders, is incredibly well developed for a player of his age.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if Aubameyang was in those positions when he missed, that if he would score those chances. I'm really not sure that he would.
Yeah, I mean, the only one I would have had slightly more of a fancy of Aubameyang scoring is the volley, simply because Aubameyang's volleying technique is really, really very high level, actually. I mean, obviously, he misses chances like everyone, but it's something about his game I didn't see as much of in Dortmund and didn't know he was good at. But, I mean, it's not as if we created a wealth of chances, and, you know, the goal we scored was an easy finish, but it was an easy finish based off a great run, which involved great anticipation and good build-up, actually. It was probably one of our best moves of the game, I thought, the goal. I mean, anything you want to say about it?
Yeah, I agree. It was really nice from the back. It looked really good, and Saka was involved as well, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and then eventually when the ball got worked forward, it got worked forward to Ozil, who played it into Lacazette, and then there was the ball out wide to Saka, which was fortuitously deflected right into the path of where Martinelli was running. And yeah, it was... I wasn't sure that we deserved the goal at that point in the game.
Well, we deserved it for surviving the half without conceding. I mean, I was so worried when Mustafi was announced to start. Obviously, not because, you know, everything that has been happening around him and the situation he's been in mentally and everything, but just he hasn't been playing so much, and that's just a little bit of worry. And you could have seen that when the match started, he was kind of trying to find his place, to find his game, and he was getting better and better as the match went on.
Yeah, he was really shaky in the first 5 to 10 minutes, you know, either giving the ball away or making slightly rash decisions. But as the game went on, he became more solid, slightly more confident, I think, in terms of where he would have to be. And he even got a couple of cheers for some of his clearances and tackles. You know,
Do you think that has something to do with the video and the article that went out over the weekend as well?
If you want my honest opinion, no. I think, you know, I mean, it's always good if when the players do sort of show their human side a little bit. But I think, to be honest, most of the fans had got their head around the fact that the negativity around his performances was affecting his confidence. I think you could see that a bit if you've anyone who's watched a lot of football. And I think it was, you know, football fans are fickle, you know. They'll love you until you do something shitty. You know, obviously, the more love you've earned, the more leeway you've got to do something shitty unless you bugger off to a rival. But also, equally, if you've lost the fans, it's even quicker to win them back. You know, not necessarily in a full sense, in a total confidence sense, but, you make a couple of good clearances, good tackles, you get through a game without making a mistake, and, you know, the fans be like, "Oh, well, I'm still not sure about him, but he's shown something. He's shown, you know, we're quite simple, really." You know, we like...
Yeah, and the overall mood in the club and the fans and stadium and everything has changed, improved a lot since Arteta has been appointed as well, so that helped too.
Yeah, and I think which is both the result of Arteta, but also the more general point is, you know, we saw in the last couple of years of Wenger and parts of the Emery time, there was what appeared to be a lack of commitment and apathy on the pitch. I mean, of course, footballers are massively competitive people and they all want to win, so of course they're still trying hard. Anyone that says they aren't is bullshitting. But when you try hard with conviction, it makes you do things and do more and push yourself slightly further because you have confidence that what you're doing is worth it or will have a positive outcome. And we're seeing a greater level of commitment and willingness to put themselves in slightly uncomfortable positions and to, you know, it'd been a while since we'd seen Mustafi sort of doing what he's done in the last couple of games, even though he had a mistake not so long ago, but, you know, throwing himself into challenges, trying to block the ball with more than just his feet, you know, making good clearing headers under pressure. You know, he's buying in, as are the rest of the players, and that goes a long way with fans. You know, we all know that some of the players aren't really good enough, but yeah, what are you going to do? And as long as they're playing with effort and conviction, that gets you a long way with fans, you know.
And then you have the curious case of Granit Xhaka as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always thought that Granit Xhaka is a good player that has his weaknesses, and it's all about how you deploy him. His weaknesses means he'll never be a total fan favourite because he does stupid shit, because he panics when he's put under pressure, because he hasn't got the mobility or the agility to deal with those kind of situations, and he's temperamentally slightly warm, shall we say.
Balkan.
Yeah, he's got, well, I didn't want to say it. I'll let you say it.
I won't get to say it.
Yeah, you're a little closer to the epicenter of that one, so you can get away with it. He's never going to be the player that you hope, because unfortunately for him, Arsenal fans have memories of not so long ago absolutely brilliant players in those positions, and if you're not at that level, you're never going to get quite the same level of love. But the new Arteta setup just exposes his weaknesses less, as when Wenger got it right with him at some points, he looks a better player. And the thing is when he feels confident and loved, Xhaka is also, you know, he's quite committed. And, you know, we've seen since Arteta's come in, and Xhaka's been going back to doing what he does when he's playing at his best, which is taking responsibility and trying to make things happen, or more importantly, just showing that leadership that may have led to him being slightly, you know, not 100% popular captain, but, you know, he's taking on things to make things easier for his teammates, which is a strong part of leadership. And so I think
that's exactly what Adrian Clark mentioned in the breakdown as well. Pointed out how the setup Arteta had for Xhaka in that match was keeping him on the left. The heat map showed that he was more on the left than in the middle, or anything to that, which kind of helped Saka going more forward, being more relaxed with Xhaka covering for him as well on the back.
Yeah, it allowed Saka not only to push further forward because he's got that cover behind him, but also to push wider, which is obviously, both of those elements were crucial in our opening goal. And also, you know, as Arteta has mentioned, as we all know, Saka has played a bit of left back for the youth team, but he's not a left back. And so
if you've been a left back for a month.
Yeah, exactly. So if you can have a tactical shift which allows that player to be slightly more protected, which is essentially what Xhaka's doing, and Xhaka's fulfilling that role very well, in all honesty, you know, not really making too many mistakes, being very calm most of the time. There was that one crossfield pass where he tried to get it through the smallest gap in history and it got picked off. But we all know that Xhaka is one of those players that the more, you know, when he's playing well, he's in the game a lot, has had a lot of possession. But we all know that the downside of that is that he has the odd mistake in him. But I'd much rather him going back to doing that, where there's the odd badly placed pass and we have to hope that we don't get picked off for it, than what he was doing a little bit more recently, where he started doing that thing that players do when they're under the cosh, which is not being available, not taking responsibility to the same degree. You know, his confidence must have been knocked. He was probably feeling pissed off or blah, 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 blah. Like everyone else is probably sick of Unai Emery football. And towards the end of Emery, even he started hiding a little bit, like not fully because he's not that kind of character. But it was things like that that for me knew that Emery's time was done. Because when you've got players like Xhaka and Ozil hiding, you're like, well, it's fucked, because they're the guys that normally want the ball every second they can have it. So, as you say, and of course we see that, and that's going to lead to, you know, the rehabilitation, should we say, of the player.
Yeah, it was a bit frustrating that he once again had that bad pass that almost ended in goal, that he had to redeem himself for right away. With the goal line clearance, and it's curious to see, you know, what the fans will focus more. Was it the fact that he again had a really bad pass, bad decision making that led to the potential goal chance, or the fact that he came back and defended and reacted actually really well when he noticed that Leno might miss the ball for that cross and was there to cover for him as well as he covered for Saka?
I think the fact that his willingness and his being given a role which allows a young homegrown player to flourish, that's not going to go unnoticed, and that's going to get you credit in the bank. You know that we all know that fans always love to see a homegrown player come through and do well, and yeah. if someone is clearly supporting that, you know, fans appreciate that. Any time a senior player is sacrificing themselves slightly to the benefit of a young player trying to make their way, you know, it taps into something quite instinctual and primal in our, you know, it's that nurturing, you know, in a way, Xhaka is lending himself to the nurture of a young player. And that's something that we respond to on a conscious and a non-conscious level, I think.
And the fact that with what you mentioned already, he's not hiding away, he's doing a lot, he's making a lot of passes, a lot of tackles and everything. Of course, there is a bigger probability that he will make some kind of a mistake, wrong pass or something, when there are more passes, more tackles, more and everything that he is being a part of. It's not normal, just logical normal.
I mean, sort of extending on from Xhaka, obviously Sheffield United did a very good job of blocking up a lot of passing lanes at the weekend. I mean, what did you think of the midfield beyond just Xhaka in this game?
Yeah, it was a similar theme that we had over the last few matches. Can we string more than three passes together? It's really frustrating to see, especially when you have Mesut Ozil playing as well. I thought that this wasn't really a good match for him. I think he did better in previous matches under Arteta. I expected a bit more right now. But Torreira, I mean, he's like a new person, new player since Emery left, and once again was shown here against South Sheffield as well. He was just everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, you know, seeing him in his proper position is obviously very gratifying. I mean, he's having to get through a shitload of work, and one of the downsides of Xhaka pushing so far left is it does leave even more for Torreira to do. And I noticed that even though at times Maitland-Niles was playing that sort of inverted wing-back position, at times he was going wider. So it gave Torreira quite a lot of work to do. And I thought, unfortunately, in the crucial final part of the game where we conceded, he did start to tire a little bit, which is to be expected because he's...
intense
short sprints in the last few weeks must be off the fucking charts. As you say, Ozil struggled to get in the game a bit, partly because of Sheffield United's tactical setup, but also I thought he looked a little bit tired as well, which I think showed partly in him forcing passes a bit. The weight of his passing wasn't quite there to the level we would normally expect. And he wasn't getting around the pitch or dropping in to start moves quite as effectively as he has done in some previous games. But I do think the opposition take a lot of credit for that. I mean, there's no doubt that Sheffield United were much better defensive than Man United were, and actually were much better defensive than Chelsea were, but it's just Chelsea had rather a lot of good luck in that game. I guess I'm bringing it up because one of the things that is as a concern and became an issue in this game is we don't have enough goals in the team. And we have one goal from our first choice central midfield all season, and that was Lucas Torreira in the defeat at Anfield.
Yeah, there were some stats going around with Mesut Ozil's goals, how many has he scored, and really... He had only one assist this season so far.
Yeah. I mean,
and no goals, obviously.
Exactly. In recent weeks, he's been performing a lot better, but the end product just isn't there. I mean, he's...
Yeah, I think there was one moment when I thought that Xhaka perhaps should have taken a shot rather than pass. You know, listen to the crowd when they shout every single time, but sometimes he could listen because... He did score some goals from distance, and really that could be very helpful at the moment, because with the form Lacazette is in as well, it's just frustrating not to have more goal scorers.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty is the personnel we have means we don't have that many people in central areas who can be both effective defensively and effective going forward. You know, we really do have the deep double pivot. You know, both Torreira and Xhaka are just much more effective in that deep position, even though I think Xhaka can be of value a bit further forward, actually, but it's not where he feels most comfortable. And I mean, it's with Ozil, it's not just that the goals have dried up and the assists, to be honest. I mean, was it five goals and four assists since he signed that massive contract almost 2 years ago? I mean, obviously he's missed a lot of game time in that time, but nonetheless, I mean, but also, I think Ozil's barely had any shots this year.
Yeah.
Like, I think I saw some stat that it was like less than 10 shots this season so far. Which, you know, for a player that was previously good for, you know, 8, 9, 10 goals a season, he's not even good for 10 shots in half a season at the moment. and it's not just that he's got the same reluctance to shooting, he's just not getting into areas where you can have shots. I mean, it's partly because some of his teammates aren't good enough at finding him when he does make runs, which I think has been a big problem this season. But yeah, he's just not getting into areas where you can score goals with any regularity at all. And perhaps
it has changed now that he's playing more regularly. I mean, he hasn't had really much game time with Emery, and now that Arteta is changing things and tactics and players that he's using, how he's using them, perhaps with more continuing matches, more game time, he will get into more scoring positions and the players will help him that as well.
I mean, the hope is that. I mean, obviously, it's a balanced thing as well. It's partly the nature of the players we've got are going to create less opportunities for him to get into goal-scoring positions, because essentially we have two centre-forwards and an inside right as our front three, which means he's got to offer a bit more control and a bit more possession rather than when you had, you know, I mean, Sanchez, for all his faults, is also quite a creative player. And even other players we've had, whether it be rotating Ramsey or whoever, there have been other players who can offer a bit more of that creative burden in more central areas, which then allows Ozil to break beyond the strikers, which I think physically he's not as able to do as he was before as well. I think he still covers a lot of ground, but his ability to recover and repeat sprints isn't what it was, and he's not quite as quick as he once was. It's also that thing of, I think, you know, with Arteta is obviously prioritising defensive solidity. We can see the results in that. I mean, quite apart from the fact that we're letting in less goals, I mean, our XG against since Arteta's takeover has been really low. I mean, we've let in a lot more goals than we should have done by XG, and that's partly because there's been deflections and Leno missing across against Chelsea and what have you. And that's actually been one of the things you can characterise Arteta's time in charge about at the moment, is an absence of good fortune, because according to XG, you know, apart from the Leeds game, which was very close, according to XG, we should have won every game we've played under Arteta reasonably comfortably. Which you know, if nothing else, is further confirmation that the model and the approach is the correct one. Of course, there are other things that make Arteta lucky. Before I get onto the subject of match officials, there's injuries. I mean, we have a lot of players out at the moment. I mean, we lost two more at the weekend who'll be out for a little while.
Almost three matches.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like Socrates might be a shorter injury, might be back, but Reece Nelson's out again. You know, just after being bigged up and given the serious love by Arteta, he's got an injury. Obviously, we've still got no Tierney. Kolasinac is injured for three games.
Chambers, obviously. I mean, it's like
Chambers, Holden,
all injuries in the same areas in the defense that we are still trying to, you know, get together and fix. It's hard to do that, really.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment we're missing three centre halves, a right back, and two left backs, and then obviously Aubameyang's suspended.
And now Bellerin is still not 100% match fit.
Yeah, and now Nelson's injured. So, and this was a squad that was already stretched. I mean, having let the players go, we let in the summer, we were already a little bit short manned, and now obviously Smith Rowe's gone on loan, so that leaves us one less midfield option. Which sort of makes it even more important that Ozil finds a bit more end product, because we basically don't have anyone else we can play in that position apart from Danny Ceballos. And he's still coming back from injury. Well, he's back from injury now, but obviously he just hasn't made it on the pitch yet. and apparently is none too happy about it. According to rumours from Spanish press, which take that as you will. But it does lead to situations where, in the game against Sheffield United, we didn't have a lot of options off the bench. I mean, obviously, we had Eddie Nketiah come on for Lacazette after 70 minutes. I wanted to ask you what you thought of that, first up.
Well, I mean, I didn't expect it to happen right away, but seeing that Arteta decided to keep him and not send him out on another loan, which seemed confirmed already before the Bristol City loan, but obviously, he will get some more chances. He said, Arteta said in the presser on Monday that it all depends how he will show, what he will show on training and in the matches when he gets some minutes. But once again, that thing that we mentioned before in podcasts, how there's clean slate, as Arteta said, for everyone. And Nketiah, obviously, a part of that as well. We'll see. I mean, like I said, he's obviously struggling. Nketiah didn't get much chances in Leeds match, but when he did get more, he had some end product that we are desperate for at the moment, as mentioned, with lacking goal scorers and everything.
Yeah. And I guess we have to assume that Lacazette was taken off partly with the Chelsea match in mind.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you make of Nketiah's cameo?
Well, it was just 15 minutes. I think he had one shot that was really, really off target. But it's hard to say what to expect from that appearance.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were reminded that in terms of pace and movement, he's got a lot to offer, but we're also reminded that in terms of contributing to build up play and decision making in the final at the final moment, he's got a lot to learn.
Obviously.
I mean, part of the annoying thing behind Sheffield United's late equaliser is obviously the fact that on the break we were creating chances and we were looking like we might score at any moment, but obviously we didn't.
Yeah, that's the big problem, to concede that second goal. That will, I think that if we did concede that second goal in that match or any of the previous 1-1 draws that we had, seems like all matches were 1-1 draws lately. I think that if we scored that second goal, we would score one more at least. That's just the feeling I had, that the team would, you know, just kind of move and turn around, and it just didn't happen. We should definitely use the chances more often because we don't get many.
Well, yes, and also the... We've drawn the most games of anyone in the Premier League, which obviously defines where we are on the table.
Lost the same number as Leicester, who are third in table or second.
Yeah, exactly. So, and of course, I suppose we also have to talk about the fact that just as Sheffield United scored, Arsenal were attempting to bring on Guendouzi for Ozil to try and shore things up a bit. initially he was going to bring Willock on, then he had a chat with his staff, and then Guendouzi got ready to come on, and then Sheffield United scored, and it was like, oh fuck. And then back to the drawing board.
Exactly, 8 minutes before the end of the match, just, and another deflection, another deflected goal, just so frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, what did you make of Sheffield United's goal? Is there anywhere in particular you put responsibility, or do you think it's just one of those things that happens if you're only winning by a goal late on and the other position's chucking balls into the box?
I would say the option B. I mean, we have gone a bit down during the second half, as we have done so far this season, because of the fitness and everything. We weren't 100% focused until the end of the match, but I wouldn't blame anyone on that goal. It's just one of those.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's one of those situations where I think if Maitland-Niles is a like a really experienced fullback, he probably tries to block that shot in a slightly different way and maybe doesn't get the deflection on it, or doesn't get pulled in so close to his centre half with the initial cross. But those are not guarantees either, you know. You know, a really top quality fullback might not have found themselves in that situation, but lots of fullbacks would have done. So, for me, it's just a case of if you let it continue to be a one-shot game, then that's what happens. And I suppose the comfort we can take is it's the one-shot game that we had a lot of familiarity with under times under Arsene, when things were sort of a bit more functional than they have been in the last year or so of Arsene's time in charge. So at least we're in a situation where that one shot isn't making us lose. And at least we're kind of, I suppose, being slightly more dominant in proceedings for parts of the game, if not in totality. And of course, I suppose we can't avoid it any longer. The refereeing controversy.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it has become the typical Arsenal match. Score first, get denied a penalty, a red card or something, and then concede for a deflection. It's just, you know, every single match.
Arsenal. Yeah.
It's just that kind of penalty that wasn't given on Pepe is given to 99% of other players on any other day.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's one of those ones that you can see he's playing for it. Obviously, yeah. It is. But you sort of, in real time, you're thinking, oh, is it a penalty? And then you see the replay and go, yeah, it's a penalty. And you see replay from Rangel go, yeah, he's fouled, but he's trying to make sure he's fouled. And then you look at other penalties given over the week and you're like, oh, there's so much of more fucking penalty than any of those.
Yeah, I mean, how many of those had Zaha?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, how many have we been given penalties against for exactly the same tackle in the last two or three years? You know, how many times have we had Granit Xhaka being ripped apart by commentators and journalists for making the same tackles? When the opposite
yeah, exactly. I think that's the most frustrating part about that, and the Aubameyang red card earlier on, and the Jorginho not getting a second yellow as well, is the fact that there is no consistency when it comes to decisions. Big decisions like that definitely change how the match is going.
Well, there is a consistency.
Anyone but Arsenal.
Yeah, the consistency is that Arsenal have been totally fucked over. I mean, you know, I mean, people know that I bang on about refs a little bit, but there was, what was it, that independent study that someone put out last week or the week before saying that Arsenal were the unluckiest team in the division and refereeing mistakes had already cost Arsenal 9 points by that point.
Yeah, we're in top five.
Yeah, we'll make it 11 points now, so we'd be level with Chelsea if referees were competent.
Yeah, I mean, imagine asking for referees to actually do their jobs properly. And with VAR as well. And they were instructed, starting from that round over the weekend, they were instructed to go and use the freaking monitor on the pitch side, which is there to go through the situations like that. But no, I think that's only one referee used it over the weekend.
Well, I think they sort of did as a thing that after the Aubameyang sending off, they changed it so referees could look at it for red cards, but that's all they're allowed to look at it for now.
Yeah, they have to look for red cards, but they can look for others as well.
Well, they can all fucking season, but...
Yeah, exactly. And they're not using it at all.
And it doesn't help when the camera pans to Mike fucking Riley sitting in the crowd looking all pleased with himself. See you next Tuesday, that he is.
I mean, what can you expect? It was Mike Dean and Martin Atkinson was the VAR ref and just...
I mean, the worst thing is literally about 2 minutes before that, I was actually commenting, Mike Dean's has been really good today. He hasn't made a single mistake. Like it's something's coming.
But I mean, it's true. He has been good. I think that I can't remember anything else but that incident.
Yeah,
again, could have been fixed by the proper referee in the VAR room.
And actually, I have a slight degree of sympathy for Mike Dean on that one, simply because it is one of those ones where you're like, it happens quite quickly, it's a tangle of legs, it's like, I think unless you're perfectly positioned, you're going to be guessing. But the fact that VAR looks at it and within it takes about a second to go, no! It's whether it's... And this is. I think I may have posted this on Twitter over the weekend, which is, I thought that VAR would improve things for Arsenal because you've got other people looking at things in a way that doesn't allow them to just get things wrong or fall back on bias. But then I forgot that the same people looking at the screens are the same fuckers who've been shitting us over for the last 4 or 5 years, you know.
It's a minor problem, huh?
Yeah, you know, it didn't occur to me that the VAR people would be the same, you know, tossers. I mean, just looking at the statistics, I mean, one, we've got the fact that Arsenal get booked for half as many fouls as half of the teams in the division. We've got the most yellow cards, despite the fact we're less than halfway up the most fouls. I think we get booked. Spurs have to make almost four times as many fouls to get a yellow card as Arsenal do, and there's other big teams get similar treatment. There's all the statistics about penalties, about how few penalties Mike Dean and Martin Atkinson have given us historically. But I saw another one over the weekend that in the last 64 matches, Arsenal have been given three penalties. That's one every 21.39 games. You compare that to Manchester United, who get one every 3.8 games. Chelsea, one every 5 games. Man City, one every nearly 6 games. Spurs, one every 6 games.
Yeah. You definitely get that kind of feeling while just, you know, watching the matches.
But it is that thing of, I mean, we know obviously as football fans we're all biased, and we know that we all think we get done over. But then when the statistics are so glaring, you know, and the fact that the statistically it's getting worse, despite the fact we have VAR, we've also this season had more referee mistakes made against us than any other team, despite VAR, and the fact that we've had more VAR mistakes made against us than any other team. And this is like not Arsenal fans. This is like people who are like just totting it up, and newspapers and people doing studies and what have you. And you're just like, so basically, like, it does feel it. You know, this is a time more than in a long time. We just need a break, and I think it's 5 out of the last 7 games we've been fucked over at some stage. Even, you know. I mean, even in the Man United games where Fred could have been sent off about 4 times for all the tactical foulings he was making, I think he gave away like 11 free kicks on his own, most of them tactical fouls. Ridiculous.
Yeah, it's just, as you said, it's not only the penalties and the red cards or VAR incidents altogether, but also those little things, the yellow cards that we get that others probably wouldn't get, and all the tactical fouling that other teams do against us, which stops us from doing our thing and playing our game. It's just really, really, really frustrating when you feel that a position player can make literally 7, or was it 7, I think, fouls before getting a yellow card, while you have Chaka or someone similar making first foul of the game and getting a yellow card, by the way. Just really, it makes the players angry as well, I think.
Well, of course it does.
And they have to, you know, change their game, how they are playing, and be more careful and think about that as well. It just,
of course,
influences the match a lot more than just, you know, showing yellow cards or red cards or penalties or something. It just a whole different mindset as well.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, without me getting full into full conspiracy theory mode, you know, I've had a massive problem with the way the referees in this country have been run for quite some time. I think the Premier League Match Officials Group is an organisation that has zero accountability, zero transparency. It's become much more secretive and less accountable since Mike Riley took over, and yet he's been in charge of it for like over a decade. And we all know that Mike Riley was bent as a 5-bob note when he was a referee. What was it that year when United pipped us to the title and he gave them penalties in 10 out of 11 games in a row? and somehow he was refereeing more of their games than the other referee and was giving them penalties literally every game. It was like fucking disgraceful. And since he's been in charge, it's almost impossible to get any information at all. You know, the previous regime was slightly more transparent, and we've still got the situation where I think this is the year where in recent years where there's the most referees from the southern half of England as opposed to the northern half in the Premier League, and I think it's either 4 or 5. Normally, it's only like 2 or 3, and I think it's at least half the referees every year are from Lancashire and Yorkshire. Like the rest, like, and I, because I, for some article I did ages ago, but I checked it again recently just to see if I was talking bollocks or if it had changed. And yeah, you combine Lancashire and Yorkshire, and you've got more than half of the Premier League referees, and it's been like that for ages. And so that makes you think, who's making the decisions, who's appointing these people, who's promoting these people, what's the political setup there? You know, it is. I don't know if I'd go as far to say as there is an institutional bias, because I don't think that's true. But I think there is, well, there's an institutional bias towards certain local associations, certain routes to getting up there. You've got referees moving to that area because they know they've got a better chance of getting higher up the food chain, which is, you know, a bit suspect, frankly. And there's such a significant organisation, there should be a bit more transparency about how things work. And they've been criticised a lot by ex-referees and by the person who used to run the organisation as well. But it's totally Teflon. There's no, you know, I totally understand why you want to protect match officials because they're under an enormous amount of pressure, and it would get really horrendous if other people had outside influence. But it's just, it appears as though standards have been declining for a while, compared to other refereeing in other football associations around Europe. And that's just not good enough. There's only probably about three referees in the Premier League at the moment that, you know, yeah, they might make the decision against us, but I have confidence that they're going to be good when I see their name.
Which ones? Michael Oliver.
Yeah, Michael Oliver. I mean, yeah, he's done us a couple of times, but, you know, every referee's going to do that.
He's done us less than others.
Say, what was that?
He's done us less than others.
To be honest, unless they get into Mike Dean levels of stats, I tend not to remember too much. You know, I didn't like Phil Dowd. He used to do us over, but only in away games against violent opposition. But that, I think, was just his bias about style rather than being specifically anti-Arsenal, actually. I think he just basically didn't like foreigners very much. But, like, there's really not many that I have any confidence at all. I mean, I don't mind Andre Mariner. He makes the odd cock-up. But, there's a lot of them that I just... Even if it's, like, nothing to do with Arsenal, I just see them refereeing a game, and I'm like, I don't know... Like, they get so many little things wrong, like whether it's about the tactical fouling, whether it's about judging what's... a tackle where someone's just a collision or someone's trying to do someone, you know, all those kind of things. I mean, people like fucking Anthony Taylor. Again, like, he's like, I've never seen him referee a game and I think, yeah, you're in control of this. You know what's going on. Another one from the northwest of England, I hasten to add. Only he's Cheshire, so he's just outside Lancashire. Well done to him. I'm not going to go through them all, but, you know, you just got to hope that some of the new blood is a higher standard than some of those that are on their way out. I mean, actually, I've just pulled up the list of referees. Here we go. I'm not going to read them out. But you've got West Yorkshire, Cheshire, Wirral, Lancashire, West Yorkshire, South Yorkshire, West Yorkshire, Merseyside, South Yorkshire. And then even a lot of the ones that aren't, even then you've still got Nottinghamshire, West Midlands, again, sort of just about north of centre, I guess, but yeah, and Northumberland. And the only ones that are remotely from the south of England, you've got West Sussex, where there's a referee called Tim Robinson, I've never even bloody heard of, he's only refereed one fucking game. Graham Scott from Oxfordshire. Graham Scott's a referee I have absolutely no opinions about whatsoever. Yeah, so I mean, it's anyway, that's my rant on that subject over, and probably half the listeners have left as a result of that. But anyway.
Well, imagine, you know how they said it all evens it out later on, so with everything that we have suffered through thanks to the referees and everything, you're probably winning the title soon.
I mean, if things have been evening out, I reckon Arsenal must have got some really favourable decisions back, like, before I was born. just sort of moving on from that, because obviously that's quite tedious. I suppose we have to talk about it because it's a big thing in the wider world of football. But Man United, Liverpool, did you see the game yesterday? Or Liverpool, Man United, shall I say? Sorry.
Yeah, I was watching. I didn't expect much. Kind of, you know, on the back of my head, hoping that perhaps United could end the run. I wouldn't hate it as much as I would if Spurs did it, of course. But yeah, it wasn't happening. I mean, they are just, like, you know, like, Sheffield is well-drilled team and they know what they're doing. Liverpool is similar, but with much better players.
Yeah. I mean, I found myself watching it because it was my friend, who's a Liverpool fan's birthday. And so my presence was requested to watch the game. And I thought, and I was sort of nominally, even though obviously, you know, I was very honest, I said, I don't want Liverpool to go unbeaten, but I can never support Man United. and it's your birthday, so I hope they win. But, I mean, you know, of course, it's all about the unbeaten season.
The last thing that we have left.
Yeah, exactly. And Daily Cannon Meister Lee is definitely not enjoying all the discussion.
Yeah, yeah, pointed out how when Wenger was talking about going unbeaten, invincible, everyone was mocking him. And right now it's like every season a team, a City, a Liverpool, Chelsea, they will all go unbeaten, like it's fucking easiest thing to do.
Well, it's the thing, of course, that when Wenger said it, no one had done it for over a century. Whereas, and the team that got closest to doing it in that time were Arsenal under George Graham, where they the only game they lost was away at Chelsea when they had no fit defenders and had to play a shit midfielder at centre-half. Well, that and Tony Adams may have still been in prison at that point. But we don't. We'll move on from that.
90s, fun 90s.
Yeah, exactly. But obviously, you know, it is more plausible to talk about with the City team that is of last year and the Liverpool team at the moment because they're just so good. I mean, obviously, it's incredibly difficult and the likelihood is still that it won't happen. But either way, I mean, unless they completely explode, Liverpool are going to set some horrible points total this season. That
yeah, I mean, just hard to see how to stop them.
I mean, but it's genuinely like ridiculous, like how well Liverpool are going. It's like it's slightly incomprehensible. Like they've dropped 2 points all fucking season
against Manchester United.
Yeah, like absolutely crazy. I mean, played 22, won 21, drawn 1. I mean, fucking hell. Anyway, yeah.
It's really, really crazy, really frustrating. But, you know, I saw some tweets going around, joking and everything, but kind of like accepting the Liverpool going unbeaten because they have beaten Spurs in Champions League final.
Well, yeah.
Saved us from that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I get it. I mean, it is the payoff. I mean, surely Liverpool winning the league enough after all this time is going to be punishment enough. Because we all know that the Scouse Twitter is going to be unbearable. It's going to be omnipresent, but, you know, I suppose it takes your lumps. Oh, I mean, we've still got to play them at the Emirates. Maybe we'll have some fit players by then. I don't know.
Would be like poetic justice for us to be the only ones to beat them.
Yeah, I'd fucking love that. But I mean, Liverpool also, like, literally they have no injuries now apart from like players that are in nowhere near the first team anyway. It's kind of ridiculous. But hey ho.
Yeah, we should research that. Maybe there's something in it. I mean, well,
they've just nicked our doctor, so. He's just gone off to join them, or rather he will be going. You know, we're advertising to replace him. Gary O'Driscoll, who's been at Arsenal for years and years and years. He's the one that you see smiling on the player introduction videos when they pop into the medical department. He's all the one that's shaking everyone's hand, but he's fucking off to Liverpool, the bastard. So, I mean, elsewhere, we also have further gloom, which presages, hopefully not, the game on Tuesday, which is that Arsenal women got stuffed 4-1 by Chelsea's women to knock them off the top of the table, or, well, effectively knock them off the top of the table, which is...
Yeah, in front of the sold-out stadium.
Yeah, which is not much fun. And then, of course, and Joe Montemurro straight afterwards confessed that he basically tactically got it wrong. He intentionally set up the team with a particular tactical setup, and then it fell totally into Chelsea's hands because they have managed to have a tactical setup which completely circumnavigated that, which is a bit depressing. But obviously, that leads us to the fact that we're playing Chelsea at Stamford Bridge with the men's team tomorrow night because we're recording this on Monday, listeners. What do you think? Dare you think anything?
Well, I think that they had the presser today as well, Chelsea, as Arteta, and they said that they have some anger about them and they are ready to release that anger on Arsenal. So that's really exciting before the match. And I wasn't that confident before that. And then they have this kind of attitude going in, obviously after losing to Newcastle, where even Unai Emery won.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I suppose we've got to say is that Chelsea have hit a period of really, really inconsistent performances. I mean, enjoyed ex-Arsenal youth player Hayden getting the winner at the weekend for Newcastle. That was ex-Arsenal.
He was really happy.
Yeah, I mean, that was funsies. Unfortunately, it does mean that Newcastle are level with us on points now, but anyway.
There's a bad side to everything this season.
I suppose we have to take comfort from the fact that we did outplay them for 70 minutes at our place and should have won the game with a competent referee. Can we get a competent referee? But anyway.
It will be interesting to see who will play in defence, if Socrates will recover from his illness in time for that, or will we get to see Mustafi and Luis again together?
Yeah, it'll also be interesting to see what setup Chelsea start with. Will they start with their three-man central midfield with Jorginho from the start? And if so, what will we do about that? And it'll also be interesting to see if we stick with the same front three. I mean, I guess with Nelson being injured, we may have to.
Yeah, no choice.
With Nketiah to come off the bench.
I think it's time for Lacazette to do something. I say that every match, tweeting, hopefully today Lacazette will score. Today everything changes and then...
Well, he's done reasonably well against Chelsea down the years. Well, since he's been an Arsenal player, contributing one way or another. So, fingers crossed that the same can happen again.
I think that we will have really good chances with the set pieces, because we have been really good with them. No, Pepe is taking them. I really hope that he takes all the free kicks as well, because Lacazette and Luis, okay, maybe one will go in, but I think I trust Pepe more with them. I think he has shown a bit more than they have over this season. And what I want to say is I think that Kepa on the goal is really a big issue for Chelsea, so I think that could be our chance.
Well, he's massively inconsistent. I mean, hasn't he got the worst save percentage in the Premier League this season?
I think so.
I think Leno's like 4 or 5 off the best. But yeah, Kepa, I think, is only saving like 60% or 55% of his shots, if I remember rightly. And to be fair, even the goalie at the weekend, I mean, it was very close range, but it wasn't exactly convincing goalkeeping again.
It's safe to kind of expect that Leno probably won't make the same mistake he did, because he has been consistently really good and actually saving us for most of the season, minus that Chelsea match. And it's just, you know, crazy to think that that will happen again in this match as well.
Yeah. It's a hard one to call. My instinct is it will be a draw.
Yet another draw. Draw Arsenal, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're doing this season. We're drawing, and we've had 11 draws so far. Wolves have had 10 draws, and yet find themselves 5 points ahead of us. I think Chelsea are wobbling slightly at the moment. Obviously, they are going to come at us quite strong. The fact that Saka's playing at left back will be a concern for us, but equally, if we can get him in good positions, we know that his delivery from wide positions, while not being totally consistent, can be very, very effective. And I think Chelsea's defence is a lot more vulnerable this season than it has been in recent years. I mean, they've only let in 2 goals less than us all season, despite the fact that we basically haven't had a fit defence this season. You know, yeah. we haven't had our first choice defence at any point this season.
Thanks to Leno, is that number not a lot larger?
Well, of course, that's the strange thing, is of course, of late, the XG against us has been so low, as alluded to earlier, that Leno's been a little bit underworked. Which, of course, is a good thing. Maybe that's why he's finding himself coming for crosses, but anyway. he's sort of been Stockholmed into thinking he must be making things happen or stopping things from happening. But yeah.
I really hope that we will again score first, as we did so far this month, this year. but that we will definitely score second as well. Maybe, you know, inside the 5 minutes between the two goals. Maybe, you know, maybe this is the match that things change. I can't help it. I go optimistic into everything now since Arteta is the coach.
Optimism is key to happiness, Anita, so don't change.
Or being even more sad and depressed when it doesn't come true.
You get burned for sure. You get those down moments, but you do get to spend more of your life being generally happy. So
it's worth it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm gonna go with the win actually this time because I was so sure we are going to lose against Manchester United and we didn't. I'm gonna go in the opposite way now.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hope you're close to accuracy on this occasion. So, if we're gonna win, who's gonna score for us?
I'm going to go with Pepe. Ooh. For one goal.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe a penalty or something.
Dream on, sister! A penalty at Stamford Bridge.
The referee, but whoever it is, we won't get the penalty.
We can't even get penalties at home, so why are we going to hell are we going to get one away? Okay, well, just before we wrap up, obviously there's been some other things going on. There's all these rumours that we're about to get this left-back from PSG on a Bosman on the summer.
Kurzawa.
Yeah, Kurzawa. I never really know how to pronounce his first name, I'm going to be perfectly honest. Is it Levin or Levin Kurzawa? It seems like everyone who's a massive football fan of French football is telling, no, don't do it! Except for PSG fans are going, yeah, buy him now. but I don't think he's that bad.
Maybe, you know, as an option B, as a backup or something like that.
I mean, it does make you wonder because we've, you know, if the stories are true, because obviously we've got Kolasinac, we've got Tierney, and all right, it's problems at the moment, but theoretically they'll both be fit at some stage. And their injuries don't appear to be things that should be chronic. So, you know, if Kurzawa is agreed as a transfer, does that mean that Kolasinac and his missus are moving back to Germany in the summer?
Yeah, I've seen those rumours as well. It's hard to know what to say. I'm not so too thrilled with that rumour, that prospect of Kurzawa signing. But I was hoping for, you know, more younger players, you know, for the future. I hope that was coming with Arteta and changes and everything, rather than, you know, just go short term, cheap and easy fixes, let's say.
Well, I guess on that front, I guess in Tierney we've already got the player for the future. So I suppose if Kolasinac is leaving, then signing Kurzawa on a free makes perfect sense because we need a reserve left back and there's no one coming up for youth ranks at all unless you count Bowler, but he doesn't appear to be at a level that's too close to challenging the first team. And if Kolasinac doesn't leave, then it becomes a very curious signing. Have you seen much of Kurzawa?
No.
I mean, I haven't seen like enough to give a proper scouting report, but he certainly never fulfilled at PSG the promise he showed at Monaco. He had a great season for Monaco, and then PSG I think paid 20 something million for him 5 years ago, and he was supposed to come in and take over from experienced left back Maxwell. But part of Kazawa's problem is been staying fit, so he's an Arsenal player in spirit already. In that every time he tends to get injured when he gets a run of form, which is a shame. I think attacking wise he'll offer a lot. I mean, he's a left back with a Champions League hat trick, so that tells you something. And has a lot of skill defensively. His positioning's a bit he's not, as I said, the most robust. His crossing's not brilliant, but his interplay on the edge of the box is pretty good. So in the final third, he's a bit more of an Ashley Cole than a Nigel Winterburn, if listeners know what I mean. But yeah, he's defensively suspect. So I suppose it depends on how committed to this Xhaka's auxiliary fullback system Arteta's had to develop to benefit Saka, because I can see that being a system that would work well for Kazawa, because it allowed him to really focus on going forward, and that's definitely where his strengths lie. Obviously we'll have to wait and see. Not much other news in Arsenal world. Obviously we've been linked with this Brazilian midfielder Bruno Guimarães, is it? Or I'm not very good at pronouncing Portuguese names, I have to confess, but I think it's Bruno Guimarães or something like that.
It's Eto.
Is it just paper talk? Is it just people trying to force Benfica's hand to make the signing now? Is there any actual interest or not? Remains to be seen. I mean, they're talking of a fee of 20-something million pounds. I haven't seen a lot of the player, but certainly what I have seen would suggest he's a sort of all-round midfielder we could benefit from, someone who can play in a deeper role and someone that can also break forward and get the odd goal. But I generally don't know enough about him to be able to give any more detail than that, and I'm not willing to invest any more time finding out more about him until I hear at least one report that is from a vaguely reliable source. But what we can say in other news is obviously some players went on loan. Emil Smith-Rowe has gone to Huddersfield and started for them at the weekend against high-flying Brentford, and had a couple of good shots and created a chance that Carlin Grant really should have scored for Huddersfield. And Tyrese John-Jules has started again for Lincoln and got a goal with a very tidy finish at the weekend, so good for him. He's a player that, I mean, they're both players who are basically either not technically or physically ready for the first team. Smith-Rowe's got to get his strength and fitness back, but both are too good for the under-23s, really. So it's good to see them getting a chance to impress out on loan, and hopefully they can do as well as some other players have done previously and stake a real claim. And then the other news is that William Saliba didn't play for St Etienne in the last game. He was just sort of getting fit, and he could have been on the bench for them, but they decided not to do that because he spent 2 days having quite intensive training at Arsenal in the week. So the Arsenal doctors, basically, because we effectively own him, we're giving him lots of tests to make sure that he's actually ready to play before he gets put back in the St Etienne first team. And apparently he's been cleared to play, and that'd be good for St Etienne as well, because their defence has fallen down the toilet since Saliba's got injured.
So he's used to carrying the whole defence, so he will fit right in.
Well, the stats are, I think, in the five games he's played this season between the two different injuries he's had, they've kept four clean sheets. And in the 15 games where he hasn't been injured, they've only kept one clean sheet. So that tells you something about the impact he's been having. And Claude Puel, who's now taken over at St Etienne, was definitely bemoaning the fact that they'd agreed to sell Saliba. So he obviously thinks very highly of him. And no matter, though, things that didn't work out for Claude Puel at Leicester City, he's a good and experienced coach. I mean, that's about it in terms of Arsenal news. Is there anything else you want to talk about, Anita, before we wrap this up?
Nothing really comes to mind. I think that you covered a lot right now, a lot of information.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously with the Chelsea game coming up, we'll be speaking to you about that soon enough. And obviously beyond that, sorry, my brain has stopped listeners for a second. Beyond that, we've got next weekend, we'll have the Bournemouth away in the FA Cup. We'll probably try and do some sort of podcast between the two so we can follow up the Chelsea game, unless it all goes horribly wrong, in which case we might be too depressed. And then obviously either look forward to, or depending on the timing, look back at, but probably most likely look forward to the Bournemouth FA Cup game, because obviously the FA Cup is important to us this season, because we ain't going to do shit in the league, so you might as well see what we can do in the cup competitions.
On another Monday night.
Yeah, a Tuesday night, a Monday night, a Sunday. Great. Thanks, fixture computer. And then obviously we'll look forward to league games against Burnley and Newcastle. But for the moment, listeners, that's all from me and Anita. Thank you again, Anita, for coming on and talking to me and talking to everyone else.
Always nice.
And thanks, listeners, for getting this far. If you have, as always, if you want to get in touch, you want to ask us any questions, get us to do any digging on anything, I may even look up Portuguese-speaking Brazilian footballers and learn how to pronounce their names, do get in touch with us at Daily Canon on Twitter. That's at Daily Canon on Twitter. And we'd love to hear from you. Other than that, nothing else to say, except for have a great week, everyone. Take care.
Bye-bye.